This Spotlight edition of Security Ledger Podcast is sponsored by RSA, a Dell Technologies business. RSA offers business-driven security solutions that uniquely link business context with security incidents to help organizations manage digital risk and protect what matters most. RSA's award-winning cybersecurity solutions are designed to effectively detect and respond to advanced attacks, manage user identities and access, and reduce business risk, fraud, and cybercrime. RSA protects millions of users around the world and helps more than 90% of the Fortune 500 thrive in an uncertain, high-risk world. For more information, go to rsa.com. Hello, and welcome to a Spotlight edition of the Security Ledger podcast sponsored by RSA. I'm Paul Roberts, editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. We're halfway through the month of October, and that means we're halfway through Cybersecurity Awareness Month. This is the 15th annual Cybersecurity Awareness Month, and like cybersecurity itself, the focus and importance of this month has changed a lot since the early 2000s. Back then, the biggest threats were from nuisance attacks like the NIMDA or SoBig worm, and cybercrime was more theory than practice. Today, however, destructive wiper attacks like NotPetya can cause billions of dollars in damages to corporations in a matter of minutes, while cybercrime is a multi-billion dollar global industry. How have those changes affected the mission and purpose of Cybersecurity Awareness Month? And what does National Cybersecurity Awareness Month mean in 2018 as opposed to 2003? To answer those questions, we invited two experts into the Security Ledger studios for a talk. Russ Schrader is the executive director of the National Cybersecurity Alliance, which sponsors National Cybersecurity Awareness Month. And Angel Grant is the director of RSA Identity and RSA Fraud and Risk Intelligence. I started off by asking Russ and Angel to talk about how the cybersecurity landscape has changed in the last 15 years since National Cybersecurity Awareness Month first launched. Welcome, both of you, to Security Ledger Podcast.
Thank you.
We're smack in the middle of Cybersecurity Awareness Month, which is October. Russ, you know, we're here in the 15th year of Cybersecurity Awareness Month. Sort of look back to that 2002 timeframe and talk a little bit about how the landscape has changed for cybersecurity threats and awareness, and what problems maybe the world was preoccupied with back in 2002 compared with now, today, in 2018.
Well, 2002, I had a phone, but I also had a separate piece of plastic and metal with a camera, and I had a separate piece of plastic and metal with my music on it, so it all changed. This was way before the iPhone came out, and the idea of integration of these kinds of devices was very nascent. People also weren't quite aware of the threats. It was almost like you change the batteries in your smoke detector twice a year, so you update your antivirus software twice a year. A lot of the same threats that were there then are here today, but it's just been game-changing in terms of the number and types of threats that we face and the way that our lives have become so much more integrated into our devices and the internet.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's been really interesting to watch the evolution and the digital transformation over the past 15 years. And actually, prior to working for RSA, I was a customer of RSA for online banking vendor. And I remember going out to various banks and try to convince them that this online banking thing was going to take off. And when it did, so did crime. And what we're seeing over the past 15 years is the way that individuals and organizations are interacting and transacting has dramatically changed. And in the past, there was a clear lack of focus and awareness of the consequences of their actions and the vulnerabilities that have been opened up with the technology changes have now come to realization of what that really means with all the crime we're seeing over the past 15 years. However, some of the biggest advancements I'm seeing for cybersecurity readiness and awareness around these threats are really three things. So first, it's personal. So when we first really started seeing cybercrime as a mainstream media type of topic, most people would say, hey, it's not going to happen to me. But when they started seeing their peers or family members being impacted by cybercrime, that's when people started taking it seriously. They started seeing organizations lose millions of dollars or individuals lose their identity and really struggle with it. So now the attitude has changed of it's not if but when type of mentality versus it won't happen to me. The second thing that I've seen change is the C-suite and board levels have woken up. Now, security has become a business problem, and I'm a strong believer that consequences drive behavior, whether it's positive or negative. And now there's grave consequences to organizations that don't take cybersecurity seriously. And we're seeing new global regulations like GDPR, which have massive fines that really are driving the awakening of the board level. And the third thing I see that's different is it's more of a grassroots educational effort, and the NCSA has done an amazing job really getting down to the educational level for children to start at the grassroots level so it becomes part of their DNA as they grow up.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely right. And Angel, I think that from the enterprise standpoint, RSA has done a great job. There was a phrase I read someplace about what enterprises have had to go from being sentries, you know, just guarding the fortress, to being detectives instead. And the whole fortress mentality of we'll build the wall that no one can go through or jump around is gone. And we moved certainly to layered security, but nowadays we're seeing layered security under attack. And more people are figuring out ways to get around some of those layers. So that's part of things that definitely the C-suite and the experts have had to really deal with during the cybercrime boom. The other part that enterprises are really suffering from, and this is the theme of what we're trying to push in the second week of National Cybersecurity Awareness Month, is skills and jobs. People have a hard time filling engineering posts and other posts here in the Bay Area where I am, but it also talks about that people don't think that they can really get jobs in cybersecurity. And part of what we're trying to push with the DHS this week is that you don't have to be a college-educated engineer who's been coding since age 5 in order to work in cybersecurity, that there are a lot of different jobs. These are massive enterprises that need a broad range of skills and people who have problem-solving abilities, who want to look down to the deep roots of things, people who know how to work as part of a team, people who can take orders, people who ask the next question. All these skills are kinds of things that really play out well in cybersecurity, and we're pushing for people to get jobs and to work with broader corporations, with experts in a field like RSA, and try to get those kinds of skills out there and build our cyber force network for the next 15 years.
I'm a great case study of that as well. I grew up in the financial services space. I would never have considered myself a security expert. However, as a customer of RSA, where I integrated RSA's Secure ID token into my online banking application, when I started exploring opportunity at RSA, I was asking my hiring manager why they would want me, who's not a crypto geek, to work for RSA. And his response was, Angel, what you bring to the table is that you understand the business context of what we're trying to protect. You understand the payments infrastructure. You understand it from a business practical reasoning versus being a deep security expert. We need more of those type of people in the security space so we actually understand the problems that we're trying to secure. And that's how I ended up in the security space.
So, I mean, one question is, I mean, NCSA is kind of one branch of this. Some of what you talk about, though, are really wholesale changes to our economy that really require kind of a all-hands-on-deck approach, you know, from the federal government down to the states, you know, promoting education programs and so on to cultivate this next generation of IT security workers. Has that part happened? I mean, messaging is wonderful, but do we see the commitment of dollars and resources, kind of like we saw back during the space race, to really grow this, stand this next generation of security professionals up on their feet?
I think there's always an opportunity to do more, always. And people looking at it, you have the short skills that we need immediately, where private enterprise is out there trying to send those messages and get people because they need the people now. The other part is DHS does have a program called NICE, which is about tracking different types of jobs and getting out into classrooms and elsewhere and job fairs to get people to think about cybersecurity. And that's building the longer tail. That's reaching out to underserved communities where no one knows someone who has worked in the financial industry, has worked in cybersecurity, and to let them know that this is something that perhaps no one has ever thought about in their circle of friends, but that this is something out there that really will be a good-paying job, and you're doing good at the same time, and try to get that kind of spark of imagination in youth and build what will be going on for the next couple generations. But there's always other things to do. And part of it, to pick up on something Angel said, is public awareness. The breach notification laws, which started in California, and obviously now are at all 50 states and have been really ramped up with GDPR, and certainly the new California privacy law that will take effect in some form in 2020, it really has done two things. One is originally, I think it was to help people understand that they had to do things if they were breached, to look at a credit freeze, to check their credit reports, to be more careful about their data information. And part of it was a walk of shame. Part of it was to make people who had been breached send out notifications, to have this publicized in the press as a way to incentivize others to up their cybersecurity so they're not the next front page story.
You know, you talk about how much things have changed, and it's interesting because I started covering the cybersecurity beat in 2002 as well. That was kind of my first year covering information security as a reporter. And as you said, you know, it's so funny that back then, you know, the big challenges were things like NIMDA and SQL Slammer, these kind of polymorphic internet worms that were all over the place. But there wasn't really a cyber crime angle or beat at that point. These were still mostly sort of proof of concept problems. There wasn't a clear financial motivation to them. And there certainly wasn't any kind of organized cyber criminal underground that at least that anyone could see at that point. Talk about just how the growth of cyber crime as a problem, and then more recently, I guess, nation state or politically motivated, ideologically motivated hacking has changed, you know, the reality for organizations that are doing business online.
I think part of it is, you know, it's the old Willie Sutton thing, you know, why did he rob banks? It's where the money is. So now it's kind of like, why do you have the criminals doing these gangs stealing credit card information, personal data, synthetic identity things? It's where the money is. And the money has also changed form as well with cryptocurrency, where it becomes pretty untraceable and very liquid. It becomes much more difficult to track down these criminals. And it makes it easier for them to sort of move their ill-gotten gains around. So the appeal of the growth in our reliance on the internet is understandable from a criminal standpoint.
That's right. I totally agree with that. And the reality is the digital transformation we're seeing is causing digital disruption unlike anything we've ever seen before. So now we're seeing more organizations migrate to cloud, they're leveraging mobile and IoT platforms. And with that, their attack surface expands. And that's allowing for more potential points of vulnerability. And the reality is, a cybercrime underground, the dark web forums, they have conversations around our business ecosystems. They understand the hardware, software, and security in place and how to manipulate the vulnerabilities and business logic in websites. Yet, with all the advancements in technologies, the reality is the biggest vulnerability still remains a human. Mm-hmm. Identity is the most consequential attack vector, right? So, for example, as many organizations are moving more toward agile development cycles, oftentimes code is being quickly pushed out to showcase new feature functionality and not being properly tested. And a lot of times organizations don't know, you know, how to or when or even where all the devices and soon even more beacons with IoT type of infrastructures that need to get patched. So if you look at the OWASP's top 10, so the Open Web Application Security Project, top 10 vulnerabilities, most of them have to do with coding errors. And as a cyber criminal, they're finding it much easier to leverage the vulnerability in this business logic than create their own code. Like, why bother creating something if you already have it? The other human vulnerability, we are still seeing phishing work. So at RSA, we identify over 120 new phishing attacks every hour. And in the underground, we're seeing a surplus of credit cards and credentials that they have such a surplus that inventory prices are going down, so they're looking for new and different ways to merchandise their goods and services.
Yeah.
So this whole new gray web is emerging, and that's cyber criminals are selling those types of things in plain sight on things like social media. You can see stolen credit cards being bought and sold. And so those are the types of things that we need to be aware of, that even though we have all these sophisticated attacks, the human is the most vulnerable point to those attacks.
And Angel, I mean, you know, 15 years ago also coincides with the launch of what is now RSA Archer, which, you know, these days is referred to as an integrated risk management solution. Talk just a little bit about on the tools and technology side, what types of evolution we've seen just in the last 15 years in terms of the focus and capabilities, you know, what, I guess, RSA's customers are coming to you guys for.
Yeah, 15 years ago, RSA saw a dramatic shift in the types of crime that was targeting our customers and created a whole variety of other solutions, one of them being RSA Archer. The other one was creating a whole new suite of solutions called RSA Fraud and Risk Intelligence Suite, which is a fraud prevention platform that provides views across all digital channels with centralized fraud detection and mitigation strategies that blends continuous monitoring, dark web intelligence, as well as the ability to integrate intelligence from other anti-fraud applications. Now, a fraud platform needs to be designed in a way that it can evolve with the threats as we have evolved over the past 15 years. And within that, the cornerstone of our anti-fraud platform is our Anti-Fraud Command Center, which is an intelligence team that monitors the dark web for our customers for things like phishing, compromised credentials, and other fraud intelligence. What has been interesting to see where the way that consumers have been interacting in traumatic transactions have changed, particularly 15 years ago, we were focused more on the web channel, then it migrated to the mobile channel. In fact, if we looked at our customer base over the past 3 years, we've seen mobile app transactions increase by 200%. However, the growth rate for fraudulent transactions in the mobile channel has increased over 680%.
Wow.
So, so it's a pretty dramatic increase of what we're seeing. And in fact, last quarter, of all of the fraudulent transactions we saw, 70% came from the mobile channel. So organizations are looking at their omni-channel strategies, realizing they need to correlate fraud patterns across every channel that a consumer is interacting and transacting, as cyber criminals are now gaming their contact center to go after the online, to go after their web channel. And that's a new dynamic that has evolved over the past 15 years.
You're listening to a Spotlight edition of the Security Ledger podcast sponsored by RSA. RSA offers business-driven security solutions that uniquely link business context with security incidents to help organizations manage digital risk and protect what matters most. RSA's award-winning cybersecurity solutions are designed to effectively detect and respond to advanced attacks, manage user identities and access, and reduce business risk, fraud, and cybercrime. RSA protects millions of users around the world and helps more than 90% of the Fortune 500 thrive in an uncertain, high-risk world. For more information, go to rsa.com.
I mean, one of the big themes this year for Cybersecurity Awareness Month is the need for sector-wide cooperation and coordination, that this is a problem that stretches across different sectors, financial services to healthcare to government, you name it. How are we doing on that, and what efforts are going to come out of Cybersecurity Awareness Month this year to promote that type of coordination, Russ?
Yeah, well, we certainly are continuing our theme for the month is that it's a shared responsibility. We are trying to reach all the different areas. The first week we focused on make your home a safe haven, where we had a lot of individual family-based simple action things that people could do. This second week we're talking about the workplace and finding better jobs, as I mentioned before. The third week we're going to be talking about kind of that work-life balance, because people who have doing bring your own device to work, people who learn training while they're at work, they can bring those best practices at home. And sort of we're seeing how the dividing line between our online and offline lives have changed. So has the dividing line between our personal and our work lives. So we're trying to meld those best practices together.
Sure.
Our last week, we're going to be pushing cyber critical infrastructure. We've seen some of the issues that have been happening now, certainly with threats and ransomware against cities, potential long-range breakdowns of our electrical and energy systems. We're going to focus some awareness on that at the end of the month.
Hospitals too, right? Ransomware attacks on medical facilities, yeah. Let me ask you a couple questions. You mentioned the first week was, which we're past now, but was on, you know, making your home a haven for online safety. Big changes in the home with the advent of, you know, connected and smart home technologies, right? Whether it's Nest thermostats or the Nest doorbell now with a camera integrated into it. Just a wide range of smart appliances and intelligent technologies coming into the home. Tremendously convenient, but also bring with them increased risk. What's the message around that?
Well, the message around that is know what you're getting. The manufacturers make it easy for you to set it up and use it. They don't want, you know, like programming a VHS player was 15 years ago. You want to make it just plug and play. But you need to realize that plug and play means that your password may be password or let me in or one of those really unsafe, simple ones. But people do have to take a moment and integrate it into their lives, but also integrate it into their security. With IoT, that's definitely something where you don't have a screen or you don't have click boxes or a way to indicate notices and consent where you have to pull in a different device to do that. That is definitely going to be a struggle, and it's definitely going to be a way that people are looking at how to give meaningful choices and meaningful awareness with the devices.
Yeah, and to add on to that, you know, as you mentioned, know what you're getting, but also know where it all is. One of the things I had my kids do is run around the house the other day and count up all the devices that we had connected to the internet, and I think it ended up being over 40 different devices. And then since then, we've actually found other things that's connected online that we're like, oh yeah, and that, and that, and that. And so the reality is, I think people need to understand everything they have connected, so they understand what's needed to help monitor and protect it and change those default passwords, like you mentioned. But a lot of times people don't even realize some of the things that they have that are actually connected online. And I think this is incredibly important as we enter into a holiday shopping season not too far away. It's going to be probably the most prevalent connected holiday that we've ever had in going into that eyes wide open.
So you mentioned, Russ, the safeguarding nation's critical infrastructure. Talk just a little bit about what NCSA is doing about that. And Angel, I'm sure RSA has some thoughts on the critical infrastructure challenge. That's often, I think, people would look at that and be like, gosh, what can I as an individual business or consumer do about critical infrastructure? So what is the message there regarding you know, security, the electrical grid, security of, you know, our healthcare system or our public utilities?
Sure. The critical infrastructure is basically driven mainly with our partner, the Department of Homeland Security. They work under the presidential directive setting out the 16 different kinds of critical infrastructure we have. They also are putting together larger programs to address a couple of them. Certainly, everyone is aware that financial services is part of our critical infrastructure because they've seen money draining out of their bank account and that sort of thing. The average consumer doesn't really focus on the critical infrastructure in other ways that they interact because they don't think about it the same way. For example, electricity. We wake up in the morning assuming there is electricity, that there is there. We use it without thinking about it. We're also used to a squirrel runs into the substation in the corner of a neighborhood and all of a sudden there's a blackout for 10 minutes or an hour or so. We're used to that kind of annoyance, but people have not focused on the actual larger threats that could happen. In the Bay Area, certainly there's a lot about earthquake preparedness. Have a plan, figure out what to do. Certainly in other parts of the country now, there's flood awareness, there's wildfire awareness. We're trying to get people to be aware that they have to be prepared and also they have to think about sort of what they can do in order to help protect the critical infrastructure. It comes down into a shared responsibility. You don't want your laptop being used as a, you know, as a slave bot along the way. You don't want to make yourself unsafe in certain ways. You don't want to, you know, not deal with the kind of smart devices, the smart meters and things like that to protect some of the critical infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So it's a nascent thing that I think will be expanding more in the next couple of years.
As we look at the critical infrastructure, it is really needs to be looked at the lens from a shared responsibility. And a good example is the financial services industry, where the Federal Reserve Bank created that Secure Payments Task Force, where they brought in all cross-functional private-public sector individuals to talk about what are the potential points of vulnerability in the payments infrastructure and what can we do to better remediate it against that and put out best practices around that. That's just one great example of a shared responsibility and people coming together for a good cause. Another example is as we develop connected cities, that's a shared responsibility as well. As that infrastructure starts to mature over time, it's important that we advocate for security from the start as we are creating those digital cities, and that's inclusive of everything from the payments tracks to the infrastructure to the monitoring of the data and securing the data that's being transmitted throughout that type of environment. And it all boils down to a shared responsibility of understanding how to move and collaborate together.
There's a lot more of Cybersecurity Awareness Month ahead. You've got, I noticed some Twitter chats and so on that are going to be happening. So I guess two questions. One is, where can folks find out more about what is happening and activities they can take a part in? And the second would be, you know, what are some things that if you're listening to the podcast and you're working within an organization and a company, or even you're just a consumer, what are some things that you can do to, you know, kind of improve your security posture this October?
Sure. The website for the National Cybersecurity Alliance is www.staysafeonline.org. So rather than our name, it's what we want you to be, staysafeonline.org, since we are a nonprofit. The simple tips that everybody should take to their work as well as to their home lives is to lock down your login, to have passwords that are and passphrases that are difficult to guess and to break. Length is good. It doesn't have to be as complicated with special digits and numbers as some do if it's longer. To use two-factor authentication, particularly when you're using financial information, medical information, information about your kids, and moving that into practices about public Wi-Fi. Don't use banking transactions if you're in an airport, for example, unless you have some other really good protection behind you. The second one is to keep a clean machine, and that is you have all of these patches that people are putting together to stop known vulnerabilities, but they don't work if they're not installed. Go ahead and put those updates in. Not sexy, not fun. There's no games going on while it's installing your updates, but it plays off in the long run when it makes those games safer and faster. And the third tip that's really simple is throw it out. If it looks suspicious, don't open it, don't forward it, throw it out. And then also, you have apps sitting on your phone that you opened up once to see which character you were in Harry Potter, or, you know, which golden girl your mother is like. And, you know, it's been sitting there collecting data about you for goodness knows how long, sending it to who knows who. Dump it. if you really want to know which school your kid in Hogwarts should be attending, it'll always be there for you again. But sort of strip it out of your machine and just keep yourself, a cleaner, safer machine.
To build on that, looking at it from two different lenses here, from an organizational lens, a couple quick tips for organizations. They need to start off by determining what matters most, classify it, put access controls to it. And then once they figure out what matters most, then they need to make it useless by putting things like encryption or tokenization on that, not including all data, whether it's data at rest or data in transit, and then back it up. That way, if you are a target of a ransomware attack, for example, you don't feel victim. You have that data isolated, and it's useless if a cyber criminal does get it. And then monitor the heck out of it. Monitor the users that are accessing that data. Monitor the endpoints that's going into that. Monitor your network. So those are four things from an organization perspective. On the consumer side, to build off a couple of those recommendations that were already provided, absolutely closely monitor your account. Activate your fraud alerts on all of your different financial and health-related accounts. They're free, easy to get, and that's also including your hospitality and loyalty point accounts. I'd recommend that as well. Do what I did. Run around your house. Take inventory of all the connected devices that you have and understand what's connected and what's being collected with it. Resist the click. When you see a text, email, a social media post with a promotion on it, resist it. That is very important because we're just overwhelmed with the amount of those types of messages that we're getting. As I mentioned, we're seeing 120 new phishing attacks per hour at RSA, so there's a lot of them coming. And in the post-GDPR world, consumers really need to take responsibility for their online presence. Think about everywhere they are, where they're posting information, whether it be on social media sites, gaming consoles, and then go through and check your privacy settings on all of those environments and devices and apps. Monitor your credit reports. And if you had a company that's previously collecting your personal information, you don't want them to, now you have the right to ask them to delete it and the right to be forgotten. And then read those privacy policies to really understand what's being collected about you.
Russ Schrader, Executive Director at the National Cybersecurity Alliance, and Angel Grant, Director at RSA Identity and RSA Fraud and Risk Intelligence. Thank you both so much for coming on and speaking to us on the Security Ledger podcast about October Cybersecurity Awareness Month.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Spotlight edition of the Security Ledger podcast sponsored by RSA. RSA offers business-driven security solutions that uniquely link business context with security incidents to help organizations manage digital risk and protect what matters most. RSA's award-winning cybersecurity solutions are designed to effectively detect and respond to advanced attacks, manage user identities and access, and reduce business risk, fraud, and cybercrime. RSA protects millions of users around the world and helps more than 90% of the Fortune 500 thrive in an uncertain, high-risk world. For more information, go to rsa.com.